So this is lecture 2 from chapter 17, and I think what I'm going to do in this recording is I'm going to actually include lecture 2, lecture 3, and lecture 4 all in one sort of podcast, because they all kind of link together. So this first lecture is making a protein and making a casserole, an analogy. And so what I've created this analogy because analogies are powerful ways to learn and remember. So we're talking about protein, the creation of proteins this week. We're talking about transcription and translation. And I've kind of got a way to hopefully make it a little easier to remember. So I want you to begin by thinking of Los Gatos as a cell. So imagine that the border of the town, as you go around it, that would represent the cell membrane. And then Los Gatos itself is a cell. And then in the center of Los Gatos, we have Borders Bookstore. And Borders Bookstore represents the nucleus. And of course, it's a structure that has a membrane, the walls, right? And inside Borders Bookstore, inside the nucleus, are books. And books are full of information. And so they are like what? DNA, all right. Okay, they're like DNA. And then inside the books are, like, if we're looking at cookbooks, for instance, they have recipes, and the recipes are like genes. Very good. So that's kind of my little analogy. Now let's kind of take it to the next level. In protein synthesis, the first thing you do is transcription. So let's say you go into Borders Bookstore and you decide you're going to go through this process and you're going to copy a recipe. You're going to transcribe it. And you're going to use your laptop computer and you're going to be looking at the recipe and you're going to take information from the ink on the page and convert it into bits and bytes on your computer, on your laptop computer. So that's, you're transcribing the information. And that's like copying DNA into messenger RNA, because the ink on the books is different from the electronic version of that, the bits and bytes in your computer, yet it's the same information. And basically, it's the same as DNA. It's different than messenger RNA, but the information is the same. Now we go through step 2, which is RNA processing. And in RNA processing, in terms of the cell, biology, the pre-messenger RNA stays in the nucleus. And so in this analogy, you have to stay in Borders, but as you know, Borders has a little coffee shop. It's still part of Borders. So you go into the coffee shop, sit down, and you're going to, on your personal laptop, you're going to remove the superfluous information from the recipe. And so you obviously are remaining in the bookstore, and it's like the pre-messenger RNA remaining in the nucleus for what we call RNA processing. And what you're going to do is you're going to take your little recipe and you're going to add a personal title, like, Mr. Hammock's, killer casserole, or whatever. And then you'll add that to the beginning. And then at the bottom, at the end, you're going to, I guess killer isn't a great word, really good casserole. And then at the ending, you're going to put like a little thing at the ending, like bon appetit or something, whatever it is, okay? And that's like what happens to messenger RNA. It gets a 5' cap and a poly A tail. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. And then sometimes recipes, they can go on and on in the middle, and you're like, too much information, not really important, let's get to the facts. And so you remove the superfluous information from the middle, and that is like the removal and elimination of what are called introns from the middle of messenger RNA. And once you've done that, we go to translation. In order to do translation, the messenger RNA needs to leave the nucleus, so you need to leave Borders with your edited recipe. And what happens is you then take this recipe, this processed messenger RNA and use it to make a casserole. So what you're going to do is you're going to go to your home, which is somewhere in Los Gatos, so it's still in the cell, and you're going to go into the kitchen. And, you know, I don't know, the analogy you can call the home would represent the ribosome, or the kitchen could represent the ribosome. Either one is fine. Let's just call it the home. Your home is like the ribosome. And because there's lots of homes around Los Gatos, there's lots of ribosomes in the cell, and as long as you take that recipe to any of these homes, any of these ribosomes, you'll be able to make the casserole. And that's like messenger RNA being used as instructions for making a protein. And that's kind of a nice analogy that shows you how it works. And that was really simple. That was lecture two. We will now go to lecture three, lecture three, which I entitle Transcription Copying the DNA. So in lecture three, all we're going to talk about is copying the DNA into messenger RNA. And we're going to begin with the simple version. Prokaryotes go through protein synthesis in a very simple way. Two steps. Number one, transcription. Number two, translation. And as you see in my illustration here, it's really kind of cool. You can see that because there is no nucleus in a prokaryote, the DNA is just out there, and it gets transcribed or copied into messenger RNA. The messenger RNA doesn't have to be processed, and the reason why is because it turns out that, you remember that bacterial chromosomes are circular, and all the information is really dense. There's no superfluous information in a bacterial DNA, so there's nothing to cut out. So basically, you copy the messenger RNA, and then what you do is you actually immediately just make the protein. So that's translation. So it's really pretty simple, okay? Now, eukaryotic protein synthesis is three steps. You have transcription, then because there's all this junk you want to get rid of and stuff you need to change, you go through RNA processing, so you go from pre-messenger RNA into messenger RNA, and then finally that messenger RNA leaves the nucleus, stays in the cell though, and then the protein is made somewhere in the cytoplasm, okay, once you find a ribosome, because you need a ribosome to do this. Now the key player in all of this is RNA polymerase, okay, and it has one function. Its main function is to make an RNA copy of DNA. Okay? Now, it does double duty. When we were in DNA replication, there was a special enzyme that allowed DNA to be unwound. What was the name of that enzyme? Do you remember? Yeah, helicase. Turns out that in this process, you don't have any helicase. The RNA polymerase does double duty. It actually does both. Question, what molecule is the key player in DNA replication? What's the key? DNA polymerase. Okay, remember? And remember the word derivation, poly means many, mer means segments, and ACE is an enzyme. And so remember that a polymerase, what it does is it's simply an enzyme that adds a bunch of individual segments together, and in this case, it adds many nucleotides together, in our case, to make RNA. But if you have DNA polymerase, you add a bunch of nucleotides together to make DNA. So don't get confused between that. DNA polymerase makes more DNA. RNA polymerase makes RNA. So just look at what it is, and that tells you what it makes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, there's tons of nucleotides just floating around ready to be used. Well, during Yeah, during the synthesis phase, I'm like during DNA synthesis, I don't believe there's a lot of drug protein synthesis going on. They're probably distinct. And that's why you have, remember the cell cycle, you have the G1, S, and G2. During S, that's when DNA replication is going on, and you're probably not making a lot of proteins. You do a lot of protein synthesis during G1, okay? Or even, I think, G2, but not during S. And like I mentioned, RNA does double duty. Okay, what is a gene? That's a loaded question, actually, because now our notion of a gene is very complicated. But I'm going to kind of stick with what the textbook says, and then we'll talk about where the textbook is wrong later. But for right now, we need to just kind of tell you what the standard view has been in textbooks. Yeah, do you have a question? Go ahead. Say that again. Okay. Good. So a chromosome is basically a long piece of DNA that has many genes, okay? And so therefore, you want to think of a gene as a strand of DNA, a little segment of that DNA with a promoter on one end and a terminator on the other. And so if you look at my illustration here, I've got a double-stranded molecule, and we've colored the promoter is colored green, so it's just part of the DNA. It's a certain sequence. And then down here on the other end, colored red, is another sequence of nucleotides, and that's the terminator, okay? So that's what a gene is. So a gene is everything between the promoter and the terminator. And it says, here the part of the gene that's going to be transcribed is called the transcription unit. And so you can actually see that the transcription unit sort of begins partway through the promoter region and ends after the terminator region. And that's going to be the part that's actually copied. Okay. Now there's three steps in transcription. Initiation is step one. And in initiation, the RNA polymerase attaches to the promoter. And that's what the promoter is all about. Basically, the RNA polymerase is looking for a place to attach. And it just looks for the sequence, the DNA sequence that says basically, hey, I'm a promoter attached to me. And that's where the RNA polymerase will attach. And that's basically it. And remember that the RNA polymerase also unwinds the DNA. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. There's a big, huge area of research right now regarding this. It's, it's basically what you're asking is about what we call gene expression. How does the cell know which proteins to make? And it's a very complicated process that they don't fully understand. And there's lots of research going on in this area right now. But you make a good point because, like, we have brain cells, we have kidney cells, we have liver cells, and any of those cells contains all the DNA, right? So all the information. So you could make all 22,000 genes could be expressed, but they're not. So there's a way for the cell to know, I'm a kidney cell, so you only make these proteins because these are the proteins that kidney cells make. Oh, and I'm a brain cell, so this is what, and that's quite complicated, okay? Big area of research there. Okay, step two of transcription is called elongation. And in this part, the RNA nucleotides are added to the messenger RNA copy of one strand, and so if you look at my picture down here, you'll see a double-stranded DNA, and you'll see a pink-colored messenger RNA that is being produced. Notice this kind of clear thing on top of the DNA. That's the RNA polymerase, and it's really responsible for making this piece of messenger RNA. Now, thing you got to remember is that you always add your nucleotides to the 3' end of the ribose sugar. So you'll notice that we're growing in the 3' end. And if you look at the blow up to the right, you'll see the huge RNA polymerase, which is unwinding the DNA, and you'll see the pink, it's pink here as well. You'll see the nucleotides are being added, notice, to the 3' end. The messenger, you know, whether it's DNA replication or transcription, you always only add to the 3' end. That's like the key thing you have to remember. And so therefore, we say that it copies in the 5' to the 3' direction. That's the direction that these messenger RNAs copy. Let's do a quick review of RNA. What do you know about RNA? What are some of the things that make RNA unique and special? Yeah. It has uracil instead of what? Instead of thymine, that's right. Uracil instead of thymine. What else is unique about it? Yeah. Good. It's single-stranded. What else? One other thing that's really unique. Yeah. Right. It has a ribose sugar instead of a deoxyribose sugar. Very good. Those are the three things. Okay. Step three of transcription is called termination. And in termination, the messenger RNA detaches from the template. And by the way, the strand of the DNA that's being copied is called the template strand. And when the messenger RNA detaches from the template, now you've completed transcription. And that happens when it reaches what's called the termination point. Now, I want to make a note. Your book includes lots of details about the differences between prokaryote and eukaryote transcription. Don't worry about the differences. I don't care about the differences. And all you need to know about this is you need to know at the level of my lectures what you need to know. No more, no less. Okay? Don't get confused about your book, because you can just go on and on. It could get very, very technical. We don't need to get that detailed. The important point that you need to know, though, is that in the prokaryote, messenger RNA is ready to make proteins right away. And in the eukaryote, the messenger RNA has to be processed before it can make proteins. That's the big difference. Okay? Great. Now, we're going to jump into my third lecture. And I apologize for all the, all this information at once, but we got to do it. Okay, so this is lecture 4, making proteins, RNA processing. Okay, lecture 4. So, first of all, for a question: in what organisms does RNA processing occur? Well, this is redundant. We just did this. What is it? In what organisms does RNA processing occur? Eukaryotes, very good. And so prokaryotes don't do this. Now, every piece of messenger RNA is processed in two ways. So let's just keep this at the top of our mind. Okay? Number one, the ends of the messenger RNA are modified, and the middle of the messenger RNA is modified. By the way, I see people not doing AP Bio work. Please put your non-AP Bio work away, or I will actually stop the podcast and come over to your desk. Okay, you don't want that to happen. Okay, yeah, on the podcast, and then I'll name names. You don't want to. Okay. Okay. Modifying the ends. First of all, you modify the 5' end, and what you do. Or what happens is a modified form of guanosine triphosphate, GTP, is added to the 5' end. Guanosine triphosphate. Can we all say that? Guanosine triphosphate. Very good. And there it is right there. And so it's called the 5' cap. Why do you think it's called the 5' cap? Can anyone just tell me? Why is it called the 5' cap? Yeah, very good. It's a cap on the 5' side of the messenger RNA. It's that simple. It's like a little cap. And what is important about it is it keeps the messenger RNA from becoming hydrolyzed by enzymes. And here's the deal you got to know. We haven't really talked about this yet. It turns out that nucleic acids are constantly being broken down by enzymes in the cell. This is happening all the time. So one of the reasons that this happens is viruses, when they attack cells, viruses are basically protein coats with nucleic acid inside, either DNA or RNA, and they kind of land on the cell surface and they inject either RNA or DNA into the cell. Well, if the cell is getting foreign RNA or foreign DNA into the cell, they better be on alert and they should chop that up, because otherwise the virus is going to take over the cell and start manufacturing more virus, virus particles. So you have these enzymes that are constantly going around hydrolyzing nucleic acids. So you want to prevent your messenger RNA from being chopped up. So you have to protect it, and you have to protect the ends, because that's generally where they're attacked. Also, the 5' cap tells the ribosome, attach here to begin translation. In other words, when translation happens, this is what we're going to talk about tomorrow, the ribosome has to know where to begin, and this helps tell it. You also modify the 3' end. What happens is you get a tail of anywhere from 30 to 200 adenine molecules are added, and so they're added out here at the 3' end. And what that is called a poly-A tail. Why do you think it's called poly-A tail? Yeah, Leah. Right. Poly means many, so you have many adenine molecules right there, and that's why it's a poly-A tail. Now, once again, this prevents the messenger RNA from becoming hydrolyzed by enzymes. Also, it's believed that the poly-A tail may help export the messenger RNA out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm. Okay? Yeah. My answer is always evolution. We don't know why these things are the way they are. It's probably an artifact of evolution somehow. Maybe, for instance, I can hypothesize, right? I can say maybe there was a time when there was a long chain of adenines that just happened randomly to be there, and that messenger RNA didn't get hydrolyzed by enzymes. So then that organism survived better than other organisms. So after time, the organisms had poly-A tails. I mean, you can spin all kinds of different ways, but it's really a result of evolutionary processes, I'd say. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to that. So the analogy here is that, remember my analogy, modifying the ends of the RNA, like what I just told you about, is like adding a heading and an ending to a recipe, right? I talked about Mr. Hammock's amazing casserole at the beginning and then bon appetit at the end or something like that, or, serve with wine or something, whatever, okay? I want to point out in this next slide, kind of go through what you're seeing in this picture, because there's a lot going on in this picture. So look down at the picture, and in the picture you're going to notice that the actual section of the RNA, messenger RNA that codes for the protein, is small. In fact, it's called the coding segment, and it's listed here. It's between the green and the red. None of the other stuff is actually translated. You'll note that the leader comes before the start codon. The start codon is colored green. We did this last night. What is the start codon? You remember what it is? Yeah. AUG. So the start codon for every protein is always going to be AUG. What does that code for, Sam? Methionine. Can everyone say that for me? Methionine. That's always the first amino acid. Now, whether that remains in the protein, You know, it depends. Sometimes it's removed later, but it certainly is the beginning of all protein synthesis. So the start code on AUG is right there. Between the 5' cap and the start codon is what's called the leader. And that will never be, that isn't used in the sense of being translated. Then you get a stop codon colored red here, and there's three different stop codons, and those three codons just don't code for an amino acid. And so it's like a period. You know, it tells the ribosome, okay, done. You know, no more translation. Mm-hmm. If you put a stop codon in the middle, then it would stop at that point. So that would be a screw up. In fact, we're going to talk about mutations later. And when you get a mutation that creates a stop codon in the coding segment, then you've ruined this gene. Okay, that's a bad mutation. Okay. The trailer comes after the stop codon. So between the stop codon and the poly A tail is what's called the trailer. And then you'll notice that there's this thing in the trailer called the termination signal. Don't get confused. The termination signal was used during transcription. That was what terminated transcription. So it's not being used anymore. And that's a point of possible confusion. The stop codon is actually what tells, you know, the ribosome, okay, stop translating this. The termination was signals for terminating transcription, which has already happened. Okay, you want some crazy facts? You guys ready for some crazy facts? Good. Yeah, we need a little break here. We've been lecturing blah, 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 too long. Here's some crazy facts. Here we go. Ready? The average length of a messenger RNA molecule that has been transcribed in a eukaryote. We could guess. I'm not going to have you guess. I'll just give it to you, but it's a crazy fact. 80,000 nucleotides. I mean 8,000, excuse me. Too many zeros there. 8,000 nucleotides long. Now, here's a really cool, crazy fact. The average length of a protein, what's the average length of a protein? Now, some will be much smaller than this, some will be much larger, but this is the average. Well, here you go. Answer is 400 amino acids. That's cool. I mean, come on, that is cool. I think you should tell all your friends this today. Tell your English teacher, okay? You know, just ask your English teacher, do you know what the average length of a protein is? And see if they even know, or see if they even care. And if they don't care, say, you should care because you're made of proteins, okay? You can even tell them, there are hundreds of thousands of proteins in your body, and the average length is 400 amino acids. So there, okay, English teacher. Okay, how many nucleotides are necessary to code for this protein? Can you do the math? 1,200, multiply by 3, woo! Great. Now, this is the craziest fact of all. Ready? Therefore, only 15% of the messenger RNA that is actually used to code for protein. So, because the messenger RNA is 80,000 nucleotides long, but you're only using 1,200 to code for the protein, most of that isn't even used to code for a protein. That is kind of an amazing little fact. So I think this is kind of a cool little slide, my crazy fact slide. Okay, yeah. Yes, basically about 1%, 1.5% of your nucleotides actually code for actually proteins. So 98%+ of your nucleotides in your DNA don't code for proteins. Does that mean that if there's a mutation? Well, they didn't know what they used to call it junk DNA. They said, you know, 98% of your DNA is quote unquote junk. Well, I don't think evolution would let us carry around 98% junk. You know what I mean? Why? Why bother? That's a lot of energy to copy all that junk. So they are just starting to figure out what all that quote-unquote junk is used for, and we're going to talk about that later. But after we get through all this stuff, okay? Yeah, we'll get to it. So the question is, what's going on? If only 15% of messenger RNA is actually used to code for protein, well, there's modification of the middle. So the coding segment of the messenger RNA has two different regions. There are regions that don't code for proteins, which are called introns. And the way they got this name is they're known as intervening sequences. And in my picture here, they're light pink. And they don't have anything to do with the actual protein. And there are regions that code for proteins, which are known as exons, and they're the dark pink in my picture. And the way to remember that is exons are expressed, okay? And so introns must be removed. They must literally be sliced out and thrown away, and then the exons stitched together, and there you get your really nice little messenger RNA ready to go. So how do we do this? Well, there's some molecules that remove the introns, and here's a crazy molecule. They're called spliceosomes. Can you all say it for me? Spliceosomes. And spliceosomes are made of two main parts. And here's another mouthful. I'm going to say it for you. Small nuclear ribonucleoproteins. I'll say it again. Small nuclear ribonucleoproteins. Let's all say that together. Small nuclear ribonucleoproteins. Now, if that's too hard for you to say, you can just do the abbreviation. SNRP. So you can call it a SNRP, okay? So it turns out that the small nuclear ribonucleoproteins, or SNRPs, are made of RNA and proteins. And the spliceosome itself is made of the SNRP plus other proteins. And let's see what it looks like in the next picture. So this is a really nice illustration. Check it out. Up here is our pre-messenger RNA. You'll see the intron up here. It's got to be removed. Here is a SNRP. The purple is the protein. The dark pink is the RNA. And then over here on the right, there's another purple blob, which represents proteins. They come together, and when they come together in this big blob, they're called a spliceosome. And what they do is they can go in and literally take out this intron and throw it away and stitch back together the exons. Now notice, you might ask yourself, what's RNA doing inside this spliceosome? And if you look carefully, you'll see that it helps the spliceosome recognize where the intron is, because it has nucleotides that can match up, and so then it can bring them together and the protein can kind of, you know, catalyze it and rip it apart. and then rip it out and then put the exons back together. So that's what it is. Kind of cool. Now, once the introns have been removed, RNA processing is over, which means Mr. Hammock's lecture is almost over. And everyone's like, yay! Okay? Now, pre-messenger RNA has been now converted to messenger RNA, which you see down here on the bottom. Okay? Really beautiful. And this messenger RNA is now ready to be translated, but it can't be translated in the nucleus. We can say the recipe is ready to be prepared, but you can only do this once you remove the messenger RNA and take it out into the cytoplasm, because you've got to go to the place where you make proteins. And just like in my analogy, when we left borders, we had to go and find a kitchen. So we had to go to someone's home. And so the homes kind of represent the ribosome. And the same thing is true for the messenger RNA. You leave the nucleus because you got to find a ribosome, because that's like the kitchen. The ribosome's like the kitchen, because that's where you make the proteins. Okay, the final product. Let's talk about the final product. The final product, let me walk you through it. The final product is this. A 5' cap. A leader, a start codon, which is what? A-U-G. Then it has all the codons here that are going to be translated. Then you've got a stop codon, you've got a trailer, you've got a poly-A tail. Now remember, poly-A tail, 5' cap, protects this messenger RNA from becoming hydrolyzed. We've gotten rid of the introns, and so we're good to go. Okay? Now, there is one nagging question, however. It is. It's a nagging question. And I know you're all on the edge of your seats. You've been asking yourself, but Mr. Hammack, what is the function of introns? No one knows for sure. But here are a few ideas. Perhaps they have some regulatory role in gene activity. They help turn genes on and off, just what you were asking, okay? Not sure. But one thing we are sure about, and this has come out recently, some amazing work that was recently published, is they allow for a greater diversity of proteins since, check this out, you guys, exons can be mixed and matched in different ways. This is called alternative splicing. In a recently published article in the journal Nature, check this out, this is mind-blowing, 92 to 94% of genes undergo alternative splicing. And what that means is that you can take exons and you can change their, or you might, you know, the common thing we used to think is that when you remove the introns, you just bring the exons that were together next to each other. But now what we're finding is you remove the introns, and this exon can go over here, and this exon can go over here, and you can just mix and match. You know what I'm saying? So you actually can create from one gene a number of different messenger RNAs, which therefore will make a number of different proteins. Does that make sense to you guys? Isn't that crazy? And in fact, in this article, it said that on average, this is the current, this is like December 2008, this is the current understanding that an average, take a gene, a regular gene, the average number of proteins that can be made from one gene has recently been determined to be 5.7. So let's just round it to 6. So from any given gene, we can make 6 different proteins because of this alternative splicing of the exons. This is hot off the presses, really cool stuff. And therefore, like we said, one gene can code for more than one protein, and this is going to help us explain why the Human Genome Project came in at about 22,000 genes, but we know that there's hundreds of thousands of proteins in us. And this is going to help explain this. So like I said, it may explain why the proteome, the collection of proteins in an organism, is much larger than the genome, the collection of genes. So it's really cool. I mean, this is, you guys, this is really exciting stuff, because those of you, you know, maybe it's not exciting to you, but for someone, the discovery of introns and exons was made decades ago. And the guys who discovered it, I think it was the late 70s, they discovered this. It was like 30 years ago when I was in college, okay? Exons and introns were discovered, you know, this whole thing. And then the guys won the Nobel Prize for discovering these things. But they've never really understood why they were there. It didn't make sense. It was like, why are these intervening sequences in here? Why are these introns here? They're just a mess. You got to go in and, you know, splice them out. And why don't you just make it right the first time, kind of like prokaryotes do? Why don't we like prokaryotes? It seems so much simpler. And it's only recently, after all these years, because of the Human Genome Project, that we're now starting to crack open this mystery, and we're figuring it out. And it's really exciting. And what's exciting about it is that it's counterintuitive. It's not what we expected. And that's the cool thing about science, you guys, and why it's an exciting field to go into. When you go into the lab and you're doing new experiments, you may discover something that's never been known before. And that's really exciting. And that's why, even though I'm not a scientist, I'm a science teacher, it's so exciting because, you know, I read the journals every week, you know, Science and Nature, and I don't know what I'm going to read. It's like, oh my gosh, alternative splicing. Oh, they're finally figuring out what's going on with introns. That is so cool. So that's just the neat stuff about science and where we're going. And by the way, this whole area that we're talking about now is just an exciting area of research. You know, new discoveries are being made every day in this area. Okay, that's it.